Welcome to I'm a Writer But. My guest today is Abbott Kaler. Abbott Kaler, formerly writing as Karen Abbott, is the New York Times bestselling author of Sin in the Second City, American Rose, Liar, Temptress, Soldier, Spy, and The Ghosts of Eden Park, which was an Edgar Award finalist for Best Fact Crime and a finalist for the Ohioana Book Award. Her next nonfiction book, Then Came the Devil, is forthcoming in 2025. She is also the host of Remus, The Mad Bootleg King, a forthcoming podcast from iHeartRadio about legendary Jazz Age bootlegger George Remus. A native of Philadelphia, she lives in New York City and in Greenport, New York, where she is at work on her next novel. Her latest is Where You End, her debut novel in which an unusual form of amnesia upends the lives of identical twins, forcing them to face the indelible, dangerous shadow of the past. Welcome, Abbott!
Thank you so much for having me, Lindsay.
This is so exciting. I mentioned already that I love Sin in the Second City and knew you as a nonfiction author and was so stoked that you are pivoting into fiction. So what a treat for me today.
Oh, thank you. It's a treat for me to be here. And I'm glad you enjoyed Sin. It was a fun book to write.
Oh, yes. For any listeners who haven't read it, I'm sure there's very few. Go get that book. It's so good. Chicago's such a wild place.
Yeah, definitely.
You're here to talk about Where You End, which is your debut novel.
And yeah, just out 2 weeks ago.
Oh my gosh, I can't believe it. I feel like it's doing really well. There's so much buzz. People are loving it. How do you feel having it out?
You know, it was really terrifying and scary to make the pivot from nonfiction to fiction. It's just an entirely new world with new, you know, the process itself was kind of really wild to make that transition, but my bar was set pretty low. I mean, my bar was set for, I hope nothing terrible happens. And so far, nothing terrible has happened, and a few nice things have happened. You know, it was a GMA Buzz pick, and a CBS yes. Book Club pick, and a People Magazine pick, and an Amazon pick, and a couple other things. And the New York Times just gave it a nice review in this little thriller roundup.
Oh my God, I was
super psyched about. So yeah, so far it's better than I expected, which is about in publishing all you can, you know, the best you can hope for.
You're a pro for going into it thinking like that, because that's exactly the right mindset. And then everything that happens is just gravy, right?
Like it's exactly. Just, yeah. Yeah. You just have to go into it expecting nothing.
The People Book of the Week, I feel, is like the pinnacle for me. Because yeah. I remember my whole life being like, ooh, what books are people recommending? You know, like this is going to be good.
Yeah. So I hope so. Yeah. I mean, I try to keep myself in the dark as much as possible.
That's for the best. That's for the best. Yeah. Let the business people do the business and the creative exactly. people can do the creating. But I would love for you to read a little bit of it before we get started, if that works.
Sure. I will start with the prologue just to set the scene. This is the book is set in two different timelines, the 1980s and the 1970s. And it's back and forth between two identical twin sisters, Kat and Jude. So the prologue starts with Kat in March of 1983. Kat, now, the night of the accident, March 1983. It was just like me to go ahead and die, leaving her behind. That's what I'd hear her say if I could hear her at all. Foolish, careless, typical. Expected, even. Another instance in which she was forced to clean up my mess and to my mistakes. Her guillotine voice would curse me in the sweetest tones. She would softly rake her bloody fingernails against my lifeless arm. She would say all the right things to lure me back and keep all the wrong things to herself. On that night, we left the old neighborhood just as the rain began to fall. I ran first. I've always gone first. Leading her back the way we came. Through a colony of dusty relics, across a lush runway of grass. Down a street where the homes are crowded with ghosts. I was not right. There was a pulsing inside my head, the tempo and weight of a thousand percussive drums, but I convinced myself otherwise, let my mind talk me into believing my own lies. As we set off, me behind the wheel and my twin sister by my side, the rain stopped and I felt a shivery relief. The clouds cleared and the full moon shot its light through the craggy branches, illuminating the road ahead. I saw the deer's body right before I swerved hard right. Its long neck snapped unnaturally back. Then came a tree and a sheet of glass and the feeling that my head had launched away from my body, soaring into the sky, too far for me to retrieve it. I had time to form one last thought before my mind emptied itself of all things. She will know how to fix me. There you
Thank
go.
you so much. What a good little taste of what's to come.
Yeah, I thought that was a fun place to start because, Kat knows that Jude is the only one who can fix her, and Jude realizes she is the only one who can remake Kat. In her words, she wants to remake her sister.
I can't even imagine where that feels like such an ambitious story to go for. Like it almost gives me anxiety.
Well, it was inspired by Trovez.
Yes, I read that, but I couldn't. I from the little Googling that I did, I never let myself find out too much about a book before I read it. So I would love to hear what that was based on.
It was a fascinating documentary I happened upon in 2019. It was called "Tell Me Who I Am," and it told the story of two British identical twins, Alex and Marcus Lewis. And when Alex was 18, he suffered a motorcycle accident and had resulted in a traumatic brain injury. And when he woke up from his coma, the only things he remembered were Marcus's face and name, his twin brother's face and name. He didn't remember their history, any of their memories. He didn't remember any of their other friends. He didn't remember any, other family members or anything from their past. He only remembered his brother's face and name.
Wow.
So in this tragedy, Marcus saw an opportunity that he was going to reinvent his and his brother's past, make up a bunch of beautiful, lovely little lies, and sort of try to, create this entire life that they never actually lived. And I was really, really fascinated by the idea of doing that. And also thought about my own family. My mom is an identical twin. In fact, like the twins in the book, they're mirror twins. She was a mirror twin, which is this, very rare phenomenon that happens when the embryo splits later than usual. And the result of that is that, one twin will be left-handed, one twin is right-handed. They part their hair at opposite sides. And looking at each other is akin to looking in a mirror. And my mother and her sister had this really freakish, incredibly close bond, including with the secret language that I sort of appropriated for the novel.
Yes, I
And
was going to ask you about
yeah.
that.
And I was very curious, what would my mom and her sister would have done in this situation? And just sort of got my imagination flowing from that.
It feels like the actual story that you've based this on, that Alex and Marcus, is sinister in a way. But and
Yeah.
so I can see that, like I can see one of the things that happens as you read the book, and I mean, I guess we're gonna have to talk about spoilers. So anyone who hasn't read it, go read it and then listen to this. Let's just get that out of the way. But I think there's like this assumption that sort of builds as you're reading the book that Kat is sinister in some way. I'm sorry, not Kat, Jude, that Jude
Yeah.
is like keeping things from Kat for a bad reason.
Yeah. And I wanted that ambiguity. I wanted people to not, oh, Jude is obviously lying. If Jude wasn't lying, there wouldn't be a book, right? So we know Jude is lying, but we don't know why and exactly what she's lying about. And I wanted the reader to feel that suspicion along with Kat. And I think there's a point in the book where Kat says, "Maybe I remember Jude not because she's my sister and we share this really amazing close bond, but maybe my brain remembered her because it was a warning, that Jude is somebody I should be wary of." And I wanted the reader to have that same feeling. And it was important to me that the reader, Kat goes along her life trying to relearn herself, trying to recreate her identity. And I wanted the reader to have those revelations along with Kat, trying to figure out who she was and what really happened.
Has that ever happened to you prior to that documentary where you thought, oh my God, I think I could write a novel about this, but you didn't for some reason?
Yeah, I mean, I actually started out writing novels, not writing novels, but writing fiction when I was a kid. Fiction was always my first love. And I used to submit stories to Ellery Queen and Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine when I was little, like 10 or 11. And I remember one in particular was called Tea with Mr. Roper.
I read
Like,
about this.
oh, you did? Like, I loved, I it's just so weird to think about now. But every Gen X kid was obsessed with Three's Company. So my story was called Tea with Mr. Roper, and about this lonely widow who would invite her neighbor, Mr. Roper, for tea every day, and she would talk his ear off and about the good old days and her dead husband and all this. And of course, at the end, the revelation is that Mr. Roper was a decaying corpse in her pantry.
The best. So
Yeah,
good.
that she would trot out every day for a spot of tea. And I don't know why my mother didn't put me into therapy, but and shockingly, none of Mr. Roper was never published. None of my stories were published, but I accidentally fell into journalism from that. from there, not fiction, but fiction's always been in the back of my mind.
I think that's part, like such a crucial part of childhood that we need to nurture because children, their imaginations are incredibly violent. I just know that
Yes.
from my own children. And you can look at it one of two ways. One is, oh, what's going on? What am I doing wrong? Or you can look at it like they're trying to understand the stakes, right? And like stretching. And I like, what a boon that your mother and father were like, like she's figuring things out. It's okay.
My mother very much encouraged me and, even wanted me to, I signed up for, when I was 12, like a mystery writing class. And it got canceled and I think I cried for like a week. But my mother really nurtured my love for books and for that I'm forever grateful.
Yeah, I mean, look what she hath wrought, right?
Yeah,
Like
but it's
so
also
many
like
books.
in the 70s and 80s, I mean, the parents just didn't monitor what kids were watching. I mean, I would watch the most horrific violent movies and TV shows and nobody cared. I think parents are much more vigilant about that now, but I just remember watching, Alfred Hitchcock all the time and these sort of creepy slasher flicks of the 70s and it was just fine. It was all fine.
It was fine. I watched The Shining when I was in second grade on a sleepover,
Yeah.
and I thought it was hilarious. And it wasn't until I was
Yeah.
an adult and watched it again and was like, oh no, this is truly terrifying. But like kids have access to this like other like we have access children have access to this other aspect of life, I feel, than that's closer to them than it is to an adult. And so
Yeah.
I think we're, I don't know, in some ways better able to shake that off. Or
Yeah, and we lose that. It's true. Kids have I think kids can interpret things in ways that are not, that are different from what they're intended to be.
yes.
And that can either go very well or very badly. But yeah, I think you're right. Children do have that sort of gift to do that.
It's similar to how a writer convinces themselves, like, yes, I will start this project.
Yes, I will write 1,000 words a day.
Of course, I will. I am accessing an important childlike part of myself that needs to be nurtured. What about this? Like, how did you keep yourself in this project? What about it helped you bring it to fruition?
Yeah, well, I was working on a nonfiction book at the same time that I was under contract for. And then the pandemic hit, and I had not been able to go to any archives yet for my nonfiction. So I was like, crap, what am I gonna do? And I remembered the documentary, 2 months earlier, and was just like, I'm just gonna go for it. During this time when I can't go to archives, I'm going to keep writing, and I'm gonna start working on this book. And the interesting thing that happened during this process too was, the book is a lot about nature, where you end, to specify, is a lot about nature versus nurture. And is was Kat after her accident and her amnesia, is she the same core person she had been before, or are the Jude lies that Jude is telling her going to reshape her into somebody new, or does the amnesia, sort of give her a blank slate in which she forges something new? And during the writing of this book, I found out that the man who raised me was not my biological father, and that my real father is a sperm donor.
Oh my God.
So the question of nature versus nurture really, started hitting home for me, and wondering, would I have been an entirely different person had the man who donated, my biological father, if he had actually raised me? And so it really like haunted me, and during the writing of this book. And I just wanted to keep going to sort of even answer these questions for myself in some small way.
Wow, that's absolutely mind-blowing.
Yeah, it was weird. It was good though.
Yeah.
It was a good thing to learn finally, at my, middle age. It's about time I would learn the truth about that.
Wow. I look forward to the nonfiction book about that. That is so heavy.
Yeah, it's been interesting, but it's good. It's all good.
Did it feel like more freeing in a way to write fiction because you were sort of unencumbered by, fact checking and,
Yeah.
like in some ways Kat, like especially at the beginning when you're when she's just kind of like taking this step and following it to the next step and, and she meets Sab and
Yeah.
just goes with Sab, and she's incredibly free. And I
Yeah.
thought, and I wondered if that's how it felt for you as you were writing. Like I'm kind of like a blank slate here, and I'm crafting the world as I go.
Yeah. No, that's such a good question. Nonfiction, it's you can't write bad dialogue, It's impossible to write bad dialogue in nonfiction. It's the dialogue is there written out for you. You can't make a wrong turn in the plot. The plot is history has already written the plot. But fiction, it's liberating, but it's also terrifying. There's so many ways you can go wrong. If you write bad dialogue, it's on you. If your plot takes a left turn, it's on you. But it was, entirely different. I'm a very, very dedicated outliner with my nonfiction. I've written nonfiction outlines that are 110,000 words and
Oh
longer
my
than the
God.
book themselves. And I try to apply that to fiction, and it doesn't quite work that way. I do create this plot and these characters, but they eventually start to rebel. And I know people, that sounds weird because it's like, how do these characters rebel? You're completely in charge of them, and that's true. But I made them into something, and then they start to rebel if I make them do something that's against the character I created. So yes, it's still my creation, but I have to honor, once they're created, you have to sort of treat them as if they were factual, real, living, breathing people, and you can't do anything that they wouldn't have done. So I had to really refashion my outline a few times, realizing that, the things that I wanted them to do weren't going to be true to the characters I had created. So it was a lot more difficult writing fiction. I have all the respect in the world for people who write fiction and have written many novels and really, have honed the craft for that.
Yeah, I guess like I'm thinking I've tried before in my own novel writing to work with an outline, and it's always quickly abandoned because for the same reasons that you're saying, that you get to a point where you're like, well, I just made this choice because it came to me in the moment, and because of that, the rest of my outline is gonna have to be reworked or trashed.
Yeah. So
So
are you a
I'm
pantser then? Are you a total pantser?
with a what?
Oh, plotter versus pantser, seat of the pants, novelist.
Oh, I've never heard of
Like,
the term pantser. I
well,
absolutely love that.
so I, the novel, my novelist friends who talk about it, they ask, are you a pantser or a plotter? So if you're a plotter, you do the outline and you try to really adhere to the narrative you have in mind, and a pantser, writing about the seat of your pants and just seeing where the characters take you.
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to
Yeah.
use that. I'm teaching a class on the novel. I'm going to use that tomorrow night when I'm with
Yeah.
my students. I'm absolutely a pantser. Proud pantser. I think
Need a
because
t-shirt. You need a
I
t-shirt.
do. I think because it often starts with character or voice, and it doesn't start so much with plot for me.
Yeah.
But it sounds like for this novel, at least, you had this plot that you, but on the same token, you had these very distinct characters, Kat and
Yeah, I think it
Jean.
was equal on this one. The plot was there and the characters were there. Yeah.
How did you come to their voices? How did their, and I guess, it's kind of a loaded question because Kat is sort of discovering her voice as she goes, but how did you keep yourself tuned in to like what their voices would be?
Well, I had them in mind as and I found this in my life with my mom and her sister. One of them was more outgoing and more boisterous and more lively and more welcoming and warmer. And the other was a little bit, they're still a lovely person, but just not as demonstrative, I guess, with it, and a little shyer, a little quieter, a little more reserved. And so I very much had that in mind with Pat being the more sort of extroverted one and Jude being the more reserved one. And I wanted Kat to be the extroverted one because, she's the one who needs to go out and figure out who she is. And in order to do that, I think you do have to have, in order to do that freely and fearlessly as she does, you really have to have, the intrinsic personality that says, I'm a detective, I'm going to go out there, I'm going to talk to people, I'm going to investigate. And I really wanted her to have that personality because it also, I thought, and I tried to sort of put a sense of danger in there, like here's somebody who will literally do anything to figure out who she is and where's that going to lead her, and what trouble might she get herself into. And of course, she does eventually start getting herself into trouble.
She absolutely does. And it's very anxiety inducing to follow her around. And especially she starts, I love how she'll say, okay, there's another thing I learned about myself. I am someone who, likes to do new things or whatever. At one point she smashes this curio cabinet and takes out a preserved heart. And like it's this extreme act that she does, and sort of up until then you're kind of like, what's with Jude? Like where's Jude going? Like what's actually happening? And then you're like, oh wait a second. What?
So it was also, a question of, the body remembers, her mind forgets, but there was also the very interesting question, about what your body holds on to, trauma, memories, repressed feelings. And, here's Kat, this boisterous, lively, friendly person, just, doesn't seem to have any, fear of anything. And she starts behaving in these erratic ways that she can't understand, and here she is with this sweet new romance, and she's very interested in this guy, and she's happy. And then suddenly, she's acting violently, and she doesn't understand why. I really like to explore, the idea that here she is, this intrinsically good-natured person, who has clearly, some kind of dark side that's just starting in, to bubble up and to the surface. And how is she going to grapple with that? And what does that actually mean in terms of, what had happened to her and what her history truly was, despite what Jude is telling her.
I love that. And you're riveted, like trying to figure it out along the way, because it's so shocking and so over the top that you're like, oh my God, I got, and I love that Sab takes her to anger management. It is so good. It is so precious. It just makes you like him all the more.
I know. Sab is such a sweetheart, and just, how many chances was he going to give her? I won't spoil it or anything, but I kind of like how Jude inserts herself in that relationship at some point. Because the twins can't exist without inserting themselves into each other's lives.
Where did their mother come from for you and the cult?
Okay. So the mother, of course, is also inspired by a true person, which happens to be Mama Rose, the mother of burlesque star Gypsy Rose Lee.
Oh, yes.
If your listeners aren't familiar with Gypsy Rose Lee, she was an iconic burlesque performer and general entertainer of the 20th century, one of the big American icons of the 20th century. And she had this horrific stage mother. And if you haven't seen the show, you should watch it. It's, she even has her own song, Rose's Turn. She was somebody who had thwarted ambition and, this desire for stardom that never materialized. And that's what I was thinking of for Kat and Jude's mother, Verona. She is larger than life. And I think she is a broken person in many ways and loves her daughters in the best way she knows how, but is not capable of true love, unfortunately. And the cult was also inspired by a couple of true, real life cults. One of them was EST, Earn Her Training Seminars, which eventually became the Forum. But I was really fascinated by the 1970s time period where all of these human potential movements sprung up, and it was so different from the 60s. It had a little bit of flavor left over from the 60s. There was the bohemian attitude and sort of this openness and a little bit of desire to change the world and that kind of thing. But in the 70s, it started becoming monetized in a way that it wasn't in the 60s. And it was kind of Dale Carnegie meets Zen Buddhism. There's peace and enlightenment, but you're going to make money from it. I did a lot of research into EST and Werner Erhard, who actually was from my hometown, which I thought was interesting. And there was also a Upper West Side cult, Upper West Side in New York City, called the Sullivanians, which preached that the family unit, the traditional family unit, was destructive and should be destroyed, and you can't, go on a path of true enlightenment in that kind of structure. So it was really a combination of those two things. But I was very interested in this sort of banal but like strangely powerful verbiage that they memorize and internalize these sayings and phrases. And in EST, the phrase was, "Do you get it?" And it's like, "What is it?" And the joke is that there is no it. It is what you think it is. So it was kind of really, the circuitous meaning of really nothing. But it made people, think they were in control of their lives in a way that, they were before the seminar.
Like what you think is,
Exactly.
right?
Exactly.
And it's so interesting when there's children involved, and what happens to the children in cults, and
Yeah.
how they fight back or they don't, or they go along with it, or they even take a like a role of power in the cult.
Right.
I was just reading that during the pandemic, online cults like exploded.
Oh, that's so interesting. I
Yeah,
did
and
not know that.
there's there one of them is the Twin Flames. I'm sure you've heard of the Twin Flames
Yeah.
people, which I think kind of got really like much bigger during the pandemic. But yeah, I think there's like this comfort in like someone telling you what to do. I don't I think about like how there's been all these like studies that people actually prefer autocrats versus
Yeah.
true democracy, and like how that might be informing our political climate right now.
Yeah.
But there's like a kind of a parallel with what's happening between Kat and Jude, which I thought was so interesting because Kat has to place her trust completely in Jude and Jude's interpretation of the world as,
Right.
as happens in a cult. And like it's so interesting how sometimes that is something you have to do, and sometimes you have to fight against it. And if
Yeah.
you're, like Kat's true nature is to fight against it, and why that is. And I don't know, I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, I never even thought about that, that their lives, their separate lives, their lives together were sort of a parallel to that. But it's so true. I think that, and in the case of Kat and Jude is telling her how the world is, but Kat is questioning it. And she wants Jude to fill in the blanks of her identity. She's depending on her to tell her how the world is. But what happens when cracks appear in that narrative? And what happens when the version of the world that you're hearing doesn't really square with what you're seeing and experiencing out in the world when you go poking around a little bit. So I very wanted to, get across the idea that Kat is really dependent on Jude and trusts her. And the minute that trust breaks, what does Kat have? She has absolutely nothing. Jude is the only word she could trust, or so she thought. As we learned that, once she pulls with the threads of that tapestry, it just sort of everything starts unraveling.
I think it's really hard to put into words the connection that twins can have.
Yeah.
I mean, you have actual access to twins in your life that, are very close to you. I think about this writer, Maurice Meyer, who is a twin. I believe they're identical twins, and she has a whole imaginary life with her sister that's incredibly crucial to her writing life.
Oh, that's so interesting. I don't know her work.
Oh
I'll
my
have to look
God,
it up.
it's so dark, and she's someone who absolutely eschews the idea of writing from her actual life, which I
Oh,
find so
interesting.
fascinating. Everything is
Yeah.
something that she's built whole cloth from her imagination, but the imaginary world she lives in with her sister is different than what she's creating in her writing. But her sister is also like her main editor and collaborator there. And the way that she talks about it is so fascinating and wonderful and strange, and I think it can be hard for a non-twin to understand that. And I, like
Yeah.
you do that so effortlessly here. Is it because you were watching your mom your whole life, or what do you think it was?
Yeah, I think so. I think my mom, they were so close. They did have a language when they were young that inspired the language that's in the book.
Was
They
it
would
just
take
like
words.
those? I was trying to figure out the formula for it. It's like you move the second to last letter, right?
Yeah, I you just move letters around into the way that I think seems intuitive. There wasn't any, like, like the letters just go where it seems like they should go if you were going to make them another word. There wasn't any like paradigms that you have to move it two spaces over, three spaces over, but they even if it's it just they understood it. And you know, if somebody else studied it, I'm sure they could sort of get the hang of it, but it just sort of came naturally to them. It was intrinsically theirs. And it was important for me to honor that in the book. You know, and I did a lot of research on twins. It wasn't just, you know, looking at my mom and her sister. It was studying like twins in history. And you know, there's this whole question of the shadow self. You know, the gothic trope of twins is famous throughout literature. You know, Freud wrote about the uncanny, and why are we so fascinated? Why are twins creepy? You know, why do we find them creepy?
Right.
And it's I think it all boils down to that gothic idea of the shadow self, and the shadow self, you know, usually being something that's a harbinger of doom. You know, this second version of yourself that you're not quite sure what they're doing. You know, that's they might be menacing. They might, you know, there's a part of yourself that you're not quite fully in charge of. And the idea of that was just always inherently scary. And you know, I was fascinated by the idea of what happens when the shadow self doesn't exist. You know, Cat as a shadow self, her was entirely erased. And so, you know, what grows out of that? And so I wanted to sort of upend the whole trope about the shadow self and write about, you know, twins where the shadow self would cease to exist.
It makes me feel like I should have a shadow self. Like there's
Maybe
something missing.
we should
Yeah.
all have a shadow self.
I'm just going to pretend like I have one. You know, I had an imaginary friend as a child. I'm just going to bring that imaginary friend back.
Well, there you go. There you go. I mean, so then in a way you're upending it yourself, but it's a comfort. The shadow self becomes a comfort. It's kind of like
Exactly.
no matter what path I'm on, I'm not alone. And there's going to be somebody to have my back. If I do make a wrong turn, my shadow self is going to right me. So, you know, and sort of put me back on track. And I, you know, I think you can look at it either way. And of course, in the course of where you end, you know, Kat is worried that her shadow self and is dark, and then she worries that it's, you know, light, or I mean, she worries that it's not going to save her, and she's going to destroy her, and she sort of fluctuates back and forth with these two versions of the shadow self.
I want to talk a little bit about the structure and about revising,
Okay.
because there are so many pieces that you're working with that I want to talk about, like when you decided to make it this structure where we get Jude in the past and we get Kat in the present, and what that was like to make sure that everything was sort of working together and braided the way that you wanted it to. How did you do it?
Well, that's a good question because it goes back to the outlining. You know, once I realized that I couldn't really adhere strictly to a perfect outline, it was going to be, you know, mutable, and I was going to move things around. I realized it might behoove me though to have two timeline outlines. So I had an outline for the 1970s chapters, and I had an outline for the 1980s chapters of what, you know, Kat was doing here and what Jude was doing there. And that way, it like allowed me to merge the chapters in a chronology that made sense, and you know, look for ways that I could do cliffhangers or sort of where the narrative would piece together in a way that for maximum effect or maximum suspense. And so I had a lot of fun doing that because if I just wasn't feeling the 70s one day, I just went on to the 80s and wrote about Cat in the present day. And if I, you know, was in a more, you know, 70s vibe, I would just do Jude in the past. And you know, I had to spend time researching each hour. You know, I remember the 80s when I was a little kid, and the 70s, I was a really little kid, not even born in some of the chapters of the book. But, you know, I had to research the slang for each hour, make sure I wasn't, you know, using something from 1989, you know, we're in 1983. I really tried to get the 70s slang perfected, especially like, you know, what slang kids would have used. Like, I did a lot of research on specifically what children and high school kids were saying in the early 1970s, as opposed to the adults. Because so many times there would be a newspaper article reporting on slang, and they'd say, well, the adults are still saying this, but the kids say that's out of date. And so there was a couple of times in the book where it was important to me to, you know, point out that the adults were really, really like out of it, as they always are, and the kids were saying this. And I wanted to get those period details correct. I'm sure that's a holdover of my nonfiction where, you know, you want it, you even though it's fiction, you want it to feel authentic and true.
Yeah, I feel like I have a grasp of what it would sound like, and I would write it and it would be completely wrong. You know, like
Yeah.
it's filtered through so many different filters, like TV, pop culture, you know, like I.
Yeah, exactly. You know, George Jefferson is in the book.
Oh
You
yeah.
know, the Jefferons, you know,
Yeah.
flow and kiss my grits. And I did a lot of research into what the shows were at the time and everything like that. But that was probably the most fun of all the things I had to do.
I love any sort of historical fiction that is kind of like near history, right? Like history that we can
Yeah.
almost remember.
Yeah. And
So it was a
it's just
delight.
recently I feel that the 70s and 80s are considered history. You know, it's kind of like only now is this like, oh, hey, this is vintage. Is this history?
Isn't that weird? My husband was telling me, he likes to tell me things like, we're further away from the TV show The Wonder Years than The Wonder Years was from the time period that they were living
Oh,
in the
God.
show.
Oh, God, that's terrifying.
Isn't that terrible? I know.
Yeah,
And
that is
same
awful.
thing with Dazed and Confused, which is just sickening. I mean, Dazed and Confused is such a touchstone for me because I watched it
Yeah.
all the time as a teenager, and it felt like forever ago. And now we're so far removed from, I don't know, I think it
Oh
was
God.
95 or something.
Yeah, it's terrifying. And it's always interesting too how generations will look like maybe 20 years to the past for the
Right.
nostalgia. So, you know, the kids now are like obsessed with the 90s, like completely
Yes.
obsessed with the 90s fashion, music, everything. And I think about the Happy Days, you know, which is a show that aired in the 70s, but it was all about the 50s.
Yes.
And it just seems like this sort of recurring pattern where 20 years ago is the time we want to be nostalgic for.
Yeah, I
So
swear,
I know
I drive by high
the
school
80s are
kids.
longer ago, but
But
yeah.
it doesn't feel that way. I drive by high school kids all the time and they look, you could pick them up and place them in 1996 and it would look exactly the same. They
Yeah.
are, it's the 90s all over, except for the phones and the,
Yeah.
you know, the
Yeah.
devices.
Yeah, exactly.
So when you have a draft of something, do you have like a group of readers you send it to, or do you go straight to your agent? Like what's that process like?
Oh, I have a group of novelists who have been reading my stuff, all my nonfiction they would read too, which was immensely helpful for me as somebody who wanted to write nonfiction that read like fiction. So they would tell me, you know, where I had an information dump, you know, in nonfiction, you want to show off your research sometimes and you can go on for pages and pages about the most minute. I mean, I remember one for Sin in the Second City, I think I had 2 pages of about what kind of contraceptives were used in the 1900s and stuff like that, which was fascinating, but I didn't need 2 pages of it.
I want those two
And
pages.
yeah,
Give me
I
the
know.
index.
I know. I should have just put it all in the end notes. But they've been reading my stuff since I've been publishing, and they were immensely, you know, helpful for this novel because they could give me more advice. Concrete advice because they understood the structure because they work with it when it fit themselves and the genre. And so I absolutely they gave me tons of notes. I can't tell you how many times I threw out what I was doing and started again.
Oh.
In fact, after I sold the book, I threw it out pretty much and
Oh
started again.
my gosh.
No, I kept the, I mean the characters and the plot were the same, but I did a really thorough rewriting and clarifying and sort of rejiggered the cult a little bit and just did tons of rewriting, which, you know, as I can't remember who said it, you know, writing is rewriting. The famous adage, who I can't remember who said it, but yeah, and I actually like rewriting after a certain period of time. You know, it luckily my editor took 7 months to get back to me with edits, and in that time period, I had a nice, good, long distance away from it, and when I got it in my hands again, I was like, "What the hell is this?" And you know, immediately commenced on fixing a bunch of things.
I think that's so important to point out because I think for a lot of newer writers, if they write the bad first draft or something they really don't feel connected to, it can feel like, well, that's it. I'm not
Yeah.
able to do this thing that I wanted to do. But it is really true that it's really fighting through that and like, you know, keeping going.
Yeah, it is. It's a valuable thing for people to learn. And, you know, I tell everybody to read several books on writing, including Bird by Bird, you know, where she famously talks about the shitty first draft and don't be afraid of the shitty first draft.
And the shitty
And
second
everybody,
draft and the shitty
yeah,
third
and the shitty third
draft.
draft, yeah, you're going to have several shitty drafts, and that's okay. And the more critical you are of yourself, the better you're going to become. And it's I always tell people too, to try to surround yourself with people who are more experienced than you, who you think are better than you, and that's the way you're going to get better yourself.
Is that true of the novelists in your reader group?
Yeah, I think we're all pretty much on the same level, writing wise, but they're far ahead of me in terms of knowing the genre of fiction and what you can get away with sometimes and what you can't. And I'm an avid reader of fiction. In fact, I read more fiction than I do nonfiction. And so, of course, you learn by that too. But they just sort of have a handle on the market and in ways that I don't, yet. Now I'm working on it, but they just have more experience than I do.
Do you feel like dropping names?
Oh, yeah, sure. One of my best friends and readers is Jocelyn Jackson, who is a
Oh,
really
wow.
amazing mystery writer, thriller writer. She also has written a really great Southern fiction. There is God, I also said my fiction and nonfiction people, Margaret Talbot from The New Yorker, who's also really great. Sarah Gruen, Walker Frost, who's been a longtime friend
Sarah
and reader.
Gruen? I love her.
She's fantastic.
Wow.
So yeah, I'm lucky to really have some good friends who are brilliant writers.
Everybody go get their books.
Yes, go get their book.
I was really excited to see the word John in your novel.
Are you familiar? Are you Where are you from?
I live in Chicago. I grew up in Orlando, but I have some friends who are in Philly, and I visited. I love Philly.
Yeah, it's great.
And John is the best word, and I feel like it's very underused. Although I don't know if Philly would want the rest of the world to use
Yeah.
it.
Oh, I think now it's really mainstream. In a way that probably annoys Philadelphians. But back then in the early 80s, I mean, the etymology is a little bit disputed, but a lot of people believe it actually came from New York, and the word joint, hip hop, in the early 70s or late 70s and early 80s, were using it's the joint. The word joint was used a lot, and it eventually sort of morphed into John, and then became, in the Black community first, and then of course became a more catch-all phrase and embraced by everybody. To mean, it doesn't really mean people. It means, it could mean anything really, but people, unless it's a mistress or an affair person, that's like, that's my side, John. But generally just like, Steve Cheesesteaks, I love that, John, that kind of thing.
Yes, I it's a it's you can use it for so many different
Yeah, it's a
purposes.
catch-all and it's
Yes,
wonderful.
it
And I
is.
wanted to
It's
get in the book because that was when it was really starting to come into popularity in the early 80s in Philly,
yes, so good. I was like, I laughed out loud when I saw it because
I
what a delight.
think. Yeah.
Can I ask you about your name change? Or
Oh,
do you not want to
sure.
talk about that? Okay.
No, I can talk about it.
It's such an interesting story.
Yeah, it's actually a very creepy story. What year was it? It was 2013. A reader emailed me and said, that if you Google yourself, there's a result that comes up that said you died in 2010. And I, sure enough, Googled myself, which I try never to do because it's just masochistic behavior. But there was a picture of me, there was my alma mater, and it says died 2010. And I was super creaked out by this. Like, what kind of algorithm or what happened to make the search engine say that? And I actually happened to be trying to write fiction at the time and was thinking, well, it would be a good idea to write under a different name for a different genre. A lot of my old friends had already called me Abbott, and Kaler is my husband's name. So it's like, Abbott Kaler, it has a good ring, whatever. And also, I was turning 40 at the time. So I was like, oh, I'm also in a midlife crisis. I'm going to change my name. So
Yes.
I went down to the courts. This was like 2014. Went to the courts, changed my name. I've been Abbott Kaler for 10 years now, but I couldn't use it on my books. I was writing nonfiction. They're like, you're established as Karen Abbott. We don't want you to change it, blah, blah, blah. But with the novel, it made sense for me to change it. And I also have a nonfiction book coming out next year. And I figure, well, if I start getting momentum with the new name, I'm not going to go back and forth and confuse people. So I'm just going to write under Abbott Kaler from now on. But that is the creepy story
That is
behind
wild.
the name change.
And you weren't able, there's like no one to go to say, hello, I'm alive. Take,
Yeah.
change this, right?
Well, I had to get a bunch of people to report that it was incorrect. Like, you know how you can do Google reports. And I had to just implore all of my friends and acquaintances to get it off the internet that I was dead. Although I kind of thought it was funny, and reports of my death are greatly exaggerated, whatever. I thought it was kind of funny, but I screenshotted it. I still have it. And it's just, I don't know, maybe I'll frame it one day. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, that is extremely. Is it so? There is like a woman. There's a woman named Carrot Abbott who did die, right? Or is it really referring to you?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
I really don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, I think there was a Carrie Abbott romance writer who I occasionally got mixed up with,
Oh, got it. Okay.
like a British romance writer. But I don't know. I actually couldn't find any website for her. I found books with bylines and covers, and they were being conflated with my books.
Wow.
But I never found any like website for her. So maybe she's been a ghost. I have
Yeah.
no idea. Yeah.
I guess it was meant to be. Abbott Kaler is such a great name. Karen Abbott's a great
Thank
name.
you.
Abbott Kaler, also a
Well,
great name.
thank you. I mean,
I
Karen has now been appropriated and like,
know.
sort of been relegated to the dustbins of history, but so, which is sad because, it was a perfectly fine name and before that.
It's my mom's name and I've always loved it. I always thought it sounded
Oh.
like so strong and smart, and
Yeah.
now it's,
And it's a Danish, it's an old Danish name. It's not, it's, like I actually did research for my next nonfiction book, and there's a Danish woman named Karen in the 1920s. So it's sort of, it's just a shame because it was a beautiful name. Yeah.
I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to ask you what it's Then Came the Devil. Is that what you were just talking about?
Yes.
What's that
Yes.
about?
So it's a true story of a group of people who leave Germany in the years leading up to World War II. The chaos and unrest is starting to go across Germany. And they have this grand idea to build a utopia in the remote Galapagos Island of Floriana. And as utopias always do, it went horribly awry. It becomes a bit like Adult Lord of the Flies.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and my favorite character possibly of all time was this woman named the Baroness, who shows up with two boyfriends and a whip and announces that she's going to turn the Galapagos into Miami, which, as you can imagine, does not go over well
No.
with the rest of the people. So it's an absolutely incredible story. I could not have written this fiction. The wonderful thing about nonfiction is that it does not have to be believable.
Right.
It's allowed to be stranger than fiction. And this is certainly that. So it's slated to come out in May of 2025.
I cannot wait for that book. I cannot wait to read that. I've been fascinated by the Galapagos Islands forever.
Yeah, it's a really interesting place, and Floriana in particular is really creepy,
Did you get to
and
go?
wonderful.
Did
Oh,
you
I
get to
did.
visit? Oh.
I did, and I possibly met everybody who lives on that island. And
Gosh.
it's just really, it was completely abandoned in the 1930s, and was very, and it's still not heavily populated. Like, there's a couple hundred people living there. I think I met them all.
Oh my
But
goodness.
it's a wonderful place, and now they're doing really amazing conservation work.
I'm so happy that you came on, and I'm so happy that Where You End is out in the world and that you've joined the ranks of the fiction writers.
Yeah, thank you so much. And your support and enthusiasm for my old work really means a lot to me, too.
Oh, of course, and for your forthcoming work as well. I'm a big fan. So, thank you, thank you.